introduce ADS-CFT, and I will do just that. So I'm not going to make any apologies to more experienced people that this is too basic. It's supposed to be. So anyone that doesn't know the subject should ask lots of questions and make sure that they understand everything I'm saying. Okay, so I'll begin with sort of an advertisement, I guess. I think that by the mid-70s, we had a very good understanding of quantum field theories, and in particular, the ones that describe the strong and the weak and the electromagnetic interactions in nature. And so one open burning question was, did you have a question? An open burning question was to try and understand gravity quantum mechanically, so to come up with some kind of a quantum theory of gravity. And in some sense, string theory has accomplished that. By the mid-80s, we had some consistent descriptions of perturbative string theory, so that we could calculate S matrices in perturbation theory for a quantum gravitational theory that seemed completely consistent. And then after work in the 90s understanding non-perturbative aspects of supersymmetric field theories, we were able to understand string theory also in the regime of strong coupling. And this has led to some, I think, truly amazing reformulations of string theory, so that now we actually have, at least for certain backgrounds, some exact non-perturbative descriptions of theories of quantum gravity. And perhaps the most amazing thing about it is that these exact non-perturbative descriptions of theories of quantum gravity take the form of ordinary non-gravitational field theories, which we're supposed to understand. So the first example was matrix theory, which claimed that some description of 11-dimensional M theory in flat space could be obtained just by taking a matrix quantum mechanics theory, so ordinary quantum mechanics that you could explain to a third-year undergraduate, and by taking the large N limit, the limit where the number of these quantum degrees of freedom in the matrices became very large. This was supposed to give you a complete non-perturbative definition of M theory in these flat backgrounds. And the second example, which will be the focus of these lectures, has to do not with flat space, but with negatively curved space, quantum gravity on ADS spaces. And in the example that I'll mostly talk about, the conjecture was that these theories were exactly described by some particular field theories in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Okay. So in principle, then, given that we should understand these field theories, we should be able to answer all the difficult questions about quantum gravity, at least in these particular backgrounds. If you were more pessimistic, you might say, well, maybe we just don't understand field theory as well as we thought, and there's a lot to be uncovered. But at least now we have a very powerful tool for addressing some of these problems. Okay, so as I said, this is going to start from the basics. And so the context of, so today's lecture will basically be some motivation leading up to a description of the conjecture itself. So how did this arise from studying string theory? And the context that I'll talk about are the type 2 string theories. So these are the 10-dimensional string theories with what people call maximal supersymmetry, so 32 supersymmetries. It won't be particularly, it will be particularly important that we have that many, but you don't really need to know exactly what the difference between type 1 and type 2 and heterotic, but the context that I'll talk about are the type 2 string theories, so there are two kinds. Just to review, these theories, of course, have closed strings, and if we quantize the closed strings and ask what kind of particles we get out of the oscillation modes, then both of those have a metric characteristic of all closed string theories. And then we have a scalar field, which is in some sense the dynamical string coupling. So the value of that scalar field at various points controls the strength of interactions of the strings. And then we have something like an electromagnetic type field, a form field B mu nu, which is called the NSNS2 form. Okay, so these are collectively known as the NSNS fields. And then we have additional bosonic fields. And this is where the type 2A and type 2B theories differ. Okay, so the difference is in the boundary conditions for fermions around this closed string world sheet. In the type 2A theory, we find, again, some set of electromagnetic type fields, some form fields. And there we find a one form and a three form. In the type 2B theory, we have a zero form, a two form, and a four form. And there's one special thing about this four form is that if you take the field strength, so if you define F5 as the field strength of that four form gauge field, then this should be self-dual. Okay, meaning that if you take the five indices of F and contract them with a 10-dimensional epsilon tensor, that you get the same thing. Okay, so these are the massless degrees of freedom, the bosonic ones. There's also fermions coming from the closed strings in type 2 string theory. And if you ask then what is the low energy physics that describes the interactions of these things, then there's basically a unique choice specified by the fact that we had so many supersymmetries and this particular matter content. And so at low energies, these are described by what are called type 2A or type 2B supergravity. Okay, well, this isn't all that we have in type 2 string theories. In the 90s, we realized that there are actually other kinds of fundamental degrees of freedom, which are the D-branes. So originally, D-brain sort of arose by considering some different boundary conditions for open strings. So you can take these closed strings and you can ask, well, are there some kind of set of consistent boundary conditions that allow me to include open strings in the theory? So one way you can think of a D-brain is just some place where these open strings can end. But later you realize that these things are actually dynamical objects. Okay, so these are some dynamical objects where open string can end. Yeah.
What do you mean with dynamical? That they can move or they can curve?
Both. Okay, so I'll explain that now. So originally these were sort of consistent boundary conditions that I can put on the strings. So it would have seemed that, so it's consistent to say that, you know, this endpoint of the string could be restricted to some lower dimensional subspace of your space. But then when you actually quantize, so when you go and quantize these open strings in a similar way, you again find some massless modes. Okay, so these open strings give rise to some dynamical degrees of freedom associated with these D-brains, so basically stuck to the D-brains. Okay, the first is this gauge field. And then the other bosonic degrees of freedom you find are some scalar fields. And these scalars tell you about how this object is fluctuating in the transverse directions. Okay, so you actually find one of these scalar fields corresponding to each transverse direction to this D-brain. Okay. So from the point of view of this field theory, you can tell by what these scalars on this world volume are doing, what that's supposed to encode what the D-brain is doing in this space-time picture. Okay. So those are the basic degrees of freedom. You have the fluctuations of a D-brain, and then you have some gauge field living on the D-brain. Yeah. Yeah, so xi is so these things are functions of this D-brain. Okay, so if I have a one-dimensional D-brain, then xi would be very much like a string, like in the world sheet degrees of freedom of a string, the fundamental string, but you also have a gauge field. Okay, so xi is just a function of the world sheet coordinate that tells me where this point maps into in the space-time.
So how does the D-brain moving on? Just the point, the neighborhood of the endpoint of the open street moving on out across space?
Well, you should think of the whole D-brain as now moving. So from the open strings, we figured out what the massless degrees of freedom were. Okay, what the light modes, what the low energy excitations of this object are, and some of those low energy excitations are precisely these fluctuations of the object.
So okay. The D-brain could bend, right?
None exactly. Yeah. Right. Good. So they're very much like if I just had a one-dimensional D-brain, it's very much like a fundamental string, except that in weak coupling, it turns out to be much, much heavier. So the mass of these things you can calculate, and it comes out to be proportional to 1 over the string coupling. So the tension of any of these D-brains is proportional to 1 over the string coupling. So at very weak coupling, these D-brains are very heavy. And it turns out at very strong coupling, actually, in the theory where you have the one-dimensional D-brains, that those actually get exchanged with the fundamental string. So looking at the mass formula, you realize they become light, and it turns out that then you can describe the whole thing in a dual description where these D-brains are now the fundamental objects.
So the fact that the visualizing at endpoint of the string, mm-hmm. is just a classical level, because quantum level, they are not localized anymore, the endpoint of the strings. Because the endpoint are like particles.
Well, I mean, once we're at this level, at the massless level, I mean, these strings are very, very... We're ignoring really any large fluctuations of the string. So if you had a lot of energy and you put it into the system, then you can actually excite these strings kind of fluctuating off the D-brains. Okay, but those sorts of energies are sort of string scale energies, so proportional to 1 over root alpha prime. Okay, and my statement here was that if we're some low energy observer, okay, so if we're say much below the string scale, then the degrees of freedom that we see, I mean, just like over here, we don't really see the closed strings fluctuating all over the place. We just see these sort of massless particles, okay, unless we go to very high energies.
The string is defined on the next type of D-brain.
Okay, so right, you can have if you want, you could have a closed D-brain like that. Or a D-brain wrapping some part of the space, or you can imagine also an infinite D-brain. Okay, so these are the massless fields that live on the D-brain, and in addition, we have some fermions. And again, we can ask, well, what is the low energy physics that we would see? How do these things interact with each other? And the answer is that they're described by some ordinary quantum field theory. So here we don't have a metric. So you basically have a quantum field theory, and that's coupled to these closed string degrees of freedom as well. Okay. Okay. Now for particular. Okay. So this field theory is living on this D-brain. Okay, so whichever dimension. So I'm about to tell you what kind of dimensions we can have. Okay, so now So now we can go back and ask, well, you know, are there any restrictions on you know, the dimensionality of these lower dimensional objects? And if we're working in these type 2 string theories, and we want to demand that the objects are actually stable, then you find that, in fact, the type 2a string theories have even dimensional d-brains, and the type 2b theories have odd dimensional d-brains. Okay, so I'll actually motivate that a little bit more in a second. So for these allowed cases that are actually stable, then the low energy theory is some supersymmetric field theory, and I'll tell you in precise detail exactly which field theory later on. But for the time being, I'll just mention that in fact there are a lot of supersymmetries, 16 supersymmetries, which is the most that you can have for a non-gravitational theory, and that amount of supersymmetry, together with some Lorentz invariance, basically determines completely the form of these supersymmetric field theories. Okay, so I'll tell you later exactly what the Lagrangian looks like that is responsible for the interactions here. Okay. So now an important fact about these d-brains is that they're actually charged objects. Okay, so Polchinski considered what happens if you have, say, two of these d-brains, and by doing a string calculation, you can ask about what sort of forces act between those brains. Now, of course, these d-brains are massive, and so there should be some gravitational force. But it turns out that the total force is actually zero between these supersymmetric d-brains. So the explanation is that, well, together with you have this gravitational force, which is attractive. Actually, the dilaton field, which also couples to most of these brains, leads to an attractive force. But that attractive force is canceled by another contribution, which comes from these Ramon-Ramon fields. So the point is that these d-brains are actually charged under those Ramon-Ramon fields, and those lead to repulsive forces. Okay. Okay, so what do I mean that by the fact that, you know, this some higher dimensional object is charged under the Ramon-Ramon field? Well, there's a specific one of these Ramon-Ramon fields under which each specific kind of d-brain is charged. Okay, and to illustrate that, just think about go back to ordinary electricity and magnetism, and one way of describing the fact that an electron or a charged particle is charged under the gauge field is that there's a term in the action. So for E and M, there's a term in the action which is just the gauge field integrated along the world line of the charged particle. Okay, so this is what tells me from the Lagrangian point of view that a charged particle is charged. And so similarly, these higher dimensional form fields, well, they're objects that are naturally integrated over some higher dimensional world volume. Okay, so a p-form is something that you can integrate over some p-dimensional surface. And so what I mean precisely by the fact that these d-brains are charged is that there's a term in the action of a d-brain, which is, so for a d, so for a dp brain, well, p refers to the number of spatial dimensions, and so the actual world volume analogous to the world line of a charged particle is p plus one dimensional, and so the charge term is to say that the d brain has a term in its action which is the integral of the p plus one form over its world volume. Okay, so these Ramon-Ramon fields were actually a little bit mysterious before we understood d-brains, but now we see that actually all of these fields has a natural object in the theory that that's charged under it. So the other form field is B mu nu is the object that a fundamental string is charged under, since we can integrate this two form over the world volume of a one-dimensional string. Yeah.
Question by Puchinsky result. Did he say that two brains are all the force is always equal to zero, regardless of the brains or between identical brains?
Yeah, I mean, so it has to be. I mean, they should be identical brains, and they have to have the same orientation, and they should also be not moving. Okay.
Excuse me. You said that there is a cancellation, so they are charged under the Ramon, but so they are charged under something else.
I said that there's an attractive force from gravity as well as this dilaton field, and then we have these. If you have two like charges, then there'll be a repulsive force, electromagnetic type repulsion. Yeah.
Are you saying that this thing can be there?
Well, in fact, it is there based on the string theory calculation. Okay, you can just calculate. You can do a world sheet calculation in string theory, for example, of this force between two D brains. Okay, so that's some diagram in string theory where you have the topology of a cylinder, and the boundary conditions here correspond to there being a D brain on one end, and the boundary conditions here correspond to another D brain, and then you can extract from that different contributions that you interpret as, or that you can show come from these particular contributions when viewed as a closed string exchange. Okay, so this particular calculation tells you that there's some repulsive contribution. Attractive contributions that you realize are from the metric and dilaton, and then there's this other contribution that comes from these Ramon fields. Okay. Okay. Yeah. In fact, right. So one of the things you can do from this calculation is actually figure out exactly what the tension or the well, both the tension and the charge of these D brains is, and you can check, for example. Actually, a nice check is that there are sort of electric. So actually, let's consider, say, this one form field. This is the thing that the D0 brain, so the particle-like brain in type 2A string theory, is charged under. And using some calculation like this, you can calculate what the charge of that zero brain is. But actually, you can also have a magnetic monopole, or the equivalent of a magnetic monopole, okay, which, because we're in 10 dimensions, is actually, so what you do is you take the field strength of this, which is a two form, and then you can dualize that to an eight form, and that corresponds to some seven form potential. Okay, so a dual way to write the degrees of freedom of a one form is a seven form potential, and so you can have that. So that's the thing that a six dimensional D brain is charged under. Okay, so you can calculate the charge also of the six dimensional object, and one nice result, or a nice check, is that those charges obey this Dirac quantization condition. Okay, so you can follow a very similar argument to Dirac's for electrons and magnetic monopoles to show that if you know the charge of a zero brain, then you should then the charge of a six brain has to be quantized in units of roughly one over that charge, and that's something you can check after you calculate all these charges. Okay, so it's very much like electrons and or electric charges and magnetic monopoles. Okay. So just to summarize, then, 2A has these even-dimensional brains. 2B has odd brains. So we have these other fundamental objects in string theory that can be that can preserve up to half of the original supersymmetries, and have some mass that we can calculate, have some charge under these Ramon fields that we can calculate, and also sometimes couple to this dilaton field. And so now we can ask, well, if I'm some kind of an observer, say far away from one of these D brains, so I should see some effect of these various charges, so I should see some kind of warping of the space because it has a mass, and I should see some Riemann fields like I would see electromagnetic fields at some distance from an electron. So there should actually be some kind of solution to the supergravity equations of motion. Okay, so there's some well-defined equations that come out of these 2A or 2B supergravities. There should be some solution that tells me what the metric and these various other fields look like at some distance from one of these D brains. Okay, and in fact, these supergravity solutions were known even before we really understood the D brains. And what they basically look like is some kind of a black hole. Okay, so for the simplest case where we just have a zero-dimensional D brain, these D0 brains in type 2A string theory, then a faraway observer would really just see what he would think was a charged black hole that also has some coupling to the scalar fields, this dilaton field. And in general, the higher dimensional brains are described by some solutions that are like black higher dimensional objects. So some black P brains. And in particular, so actually there are families of these solutions, but in particular there are some solutions that are exactly half supersymmetric, so they preserve exactly the same symmetries as these D brains. And so really after this work of Polchinski, people realized that these P brain solutions should really be associated with the D brains. Okay, so
We learned that the supergravity description was the low energy for type 2A, right?
Right.
But then you told us that the low energy description for D brains was in terms of field theory. How comes that now we have another description for low energy?
Okay, good. So the picture is that we have some space, the full space-time, which we can take to be 10-dimensional, and the low-energy excitations on that space are described by the supergravity theory. Okay, but then we can also have some other object inside the space. Okay, so some kind of membrane-like object, this D-brain, and that can also carry low-energy excitations. Okay, so the things arising from the open strings. And so it's really that you have both of the things. You have this bulk theory, which is the supergravity, and that couples to this field theory that's restricted to the D brain. Okay. Okay. But now I'm saying, well, what if I'm just over here? This D brain is going to be creating some long distance fields, and can I write down the exact solution that I could see? So this is analogous to saying that, you know, if I'm far away from a spherically symmetric collection of mass and I know that it's just vacuum outside that, then I can look for a spherically symmetric solution of the vacuum equations of general relativity and I find the Schwarzschild solution. And so I know that anywhere outside this spherical mass distribution, then the metric should be given by the Schwarzschild solution. So I'm now asking for the analog of that solution in the case where we have this charged object. And so these were known as the black P-brain solutions. I'll write down now the general solution. Okay, so the metric is defined in terms of some function h, which is a function of the distance from the D brain. And there's some part of the metric which is just proportional, which is just in the directions of the D brain. Okay, so it's proportional to the flat space metric in those directions, but it varies with the distance you are from the D brain. And then there's another part of the metric which describes the radial and angular coordinates. Okay, so again, this function comes in, but now it's the inverse of the prefactor here. OK, Okay, so this R is the radial coordinate away from the D brain, and the omega is the sphere surrounding the D brain. So if we had a describes these angular coordinates. And in addition, we have a dilaton field, which is also given by this function h to some power. And then finally, we have some Ramon-Ramon fields, and these are going to depend, which one is turned on is going to depend on which D brain we're talking about. So this function then is given by it's just a 1 plus some power law function of R that falls off as you go far away from the D brain. So if you take R to infinity, then you see that this H just goes to 1. And what you have left is just flat space. So that's basically like you would expect. If you go far enough away from your source, then your space basically becomes flat. Good. So far, R is just a parameter. And there is a supergravity solution for any value of that particular parameter.
Like a mass?
Yeah, it could. So it's obviously related to the mass, but that's also related to the charge of these objects. Okay, so now that we have, so this is just a parameter in the solution, but now that we have an interpretation of this in terms of the D brains, then we can actually associate this with some specific properties of those D brains. Okay, so for example, we can extract from this supergravity solution the mass of the object that's producing the metric that's written here, and then by identifying that with the mass that we know we can calculate a D brain should have, then we could come up with a precise formula for this R. And here it is in general. So for a P brain, okay, so this part is just a number, 4 pi to some power times this gamma function of 7 minus p. This is the number of D brains that we have, and this is the string coupling, and then this is the string scale. So this R should have the dimensions of a length, and the natural length is just this string length. Yeah?
So using this asymptotic gravitational data, several masses you can calculate, maybe a mass or some other kind.
I guess the ADM mass is the thing that people would calculate. So this is just some static solution of GR.
I'm sorry, why is this quantized?
In the classical supergravity, then we know that, there's no reason for the thing to be quantized. But so in string theory, when you actually talk about this microscopic description, then a D brain is some object. Okay, I mean it's some particular object, and it has a particular mass, and you can't vary that mass arbitrarily. You can have one D brain or two D brains, and those can be on top of each other. But you sort of by then this association with the microscopic description, we basically conclude that this should be a quantized parameter in the full theory. Yeah.
Just want to be clear, is there an applicable derivation that tells you that some silicon is the same as A? Or is it a case of looking and seeing that?
Well, I mean, the derivation would be that you can, you could certainly derive the the long distance fields of these objects. So from string theory, you can consider this D brain state, and you can come up with, you can determine exactly how these objects, how these bulk closed string fields couple to that thing. Okay, so in some sense you can derive exactly what at least the long distance form of this supergravity solution is. I think for reasons that will become more clear, I think it's difficult to start with sort of the bulk equations of motion coupled to this brain action and get an exact solution. And I mean that's actually going to be the reason why it's difficult to do that will sort of be important here. Okay. Yeah.
What is black body solution? Is there an horizon?
Yeah, okay, so good. So I mean, well, let me draw a picture in a minute and you'll see that, you know, so this metric is something that goes to asymptotically flat space as you go far away from the D brain, and you see at R goes to zero, then you have something, some function that blows up. Okay, so we'll see a precise example of what this is going to look like, but essentially you can think of R equals zero as like a horizon. So particles can, or at least, okay, at least we'll see that that massless particles can fall into R equals zero in some finite time.
G is the dilatant.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So normally what you do is you separate. I mean, normally what you can think of doing is separating off the constant value of the dilaton, which is just a parameter in the, which can be thought of as a parameter in the theory. So GS you can think of as the value, in some sense, the value of e to the phi at infinity, and then this object, this spatially dependent object, would then give you the spatial dependence as you go away from that. Okay. So this has been. This here has been defined so that it just goes to, so that this field phi just goes to zero at infinity. Okay, so you should think of this as the constant part, and then this is the fluctuation away from zero.
Where does your P brain locate? At x equals zero?
So here the singularity is at R equals zero. Okay. Okay. Well, let's go on a little bit. So this is sort of getting to the heart of this correspondence. Okay, so what I'm going to focus on is a special case here, and the special case is when p equals 3. Okay, so there are various properties of this solution that simplify in that case. Okay, so first of all, you can see that this dilaton function becomes just equal to 1 on the right-hand side, so the dilaton is actually constant in the whole space, and that's a statement of the fact that these three-dimensional D brains in type 2B string theory are not charged under the dilaton field. Okay, so phi equals constant. Another special property of the case p equals 3 is that if we look at the angular part of this space, so the size of this sphere, then this function h, okay, so actually let me write down r for p equals 3. We have r to the fourth equals alpha prime squared g string n. I should write down h. Okay, so this will be useful, times 4 pi. And then h of r is equal to 1 plus r to the fourth over r to the fourth. Okay, so as I go towards r equals 0, h of r goes like 1 over r to the fourth. And so then this h to the 1 half goes like 1 over r squared. And that cancels this r squared in front of the angular part. So that tells me that if I go in towards this singularity, then this sphere actually develops a constant radius. So it doesn't blow up, or it doesn't shrink to zero size. It just becomes a constant radius. And for this special case, I can draw the following pictures of the solution. Okay, so I'm going to, so this is going to be my D3 brain, so all of the directions, so all of the three space plus one time directions of the three brain will be here. And then I'm just going to display, okay, so I'm going to, these are x and t, so I'm going to display the radial direction and then the angular direction. So first I can take some coordinate slice. Okay, so I'm going to take a coordinate slice that looks like this and map it now to proper distances. And what I find is that this thing looks, so it's asymptotically flat, it looks the same as the coordinate picture far away from the brain. But then what happens as you go in, okay, so first of all you find that there's an infinite proper distance. If you integrate the distance from here into the singularity at r equals 0, you get a logarithmic divergence. So there's an infinite proper distance to this r equals 0. And along all of that distance, eventually, this size of this transverse angular part is a constant. Okay, so what you get is what people refer to as some infinite throat. Okay, so as you go in, you eventually get into this region where you have a constant angular piece. Okay, but the whole metric isn't actually constant. If I now take some coordinate section in the directions r and x along the brain, okay, that actually looks like, so again, it looks very much like flat space as you go far out. And then I'm going to draw this in terms of proper distances. Okay, so okay, so these separations in the r direction get larger and larger. Okay, so even though we have a finite coordinate distance to r equals 0, as I said, there's an infinite proper distance, and then the transverse space actually shrinks down in size. Okay, so in particular for the time direction, that means that there'll be a lot of redshift. So a very high energy mode down in this throat region will look like a very low energy mode out at infinity. Okay, so that'll be important for what we're about to do. Okay, so one thing that you actually conclude from this picture is that this particular case of singular. And you can do more work and work out various curvature invariants, but you conclude from this picture that actually this whole solution for p equals 3 is in fact non-singular. Okay. So nothing blows up. Okay, so in particular this in some of the other solutions then all of the other solutions, the dilaton would either blow up in infinity or at r equals 0, or the size of this sphere would shrink to 0, or a curvature invariance would blow up. But here this one is quite smooth.
R equals 0 to the water singularity.
Right, so you see from this picture that, you know, it's really an infinite distance away down this throat. Yeah. Right. So if I put different coordinates, then you would, I mean, r equals 0 would really be somewhere at infinity. Okay, along these coordinates. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. So far this was general. Okay, so I had this constant that comes into the solution is proportional to the number of D brains. Okay, but I should say that actually really in order to trust this supergravity solution, we want that the curvature should be much smaller than the string scale. Okay. The fact that this is non-singular, so the fact that the curvatures actually don't blow up, means that by tuning these parameters, and in fact by taking this n very large, Okay, then you can make the curvature scale larger than the string scale everywhere. Okay, so so you should just think of them as n on top of each other, and this supergravity solution is somehow associated. So let me go on to the next picture. Okay, so now we actually have sort of two. Okay, so now I'm going to get back to the questions of sort of where are the D brains exactly located when we have this nice solution. You know, what happened to the D brain? Should we put those in somewhere? But it kind of sounds like we have actually two different pictures now. So first I told you that you can have these D brains just sort of sitting as an object in string theory in flat space. Okay, so we get these. But now I also have this supergravity solution. That seems to be rather non-singular. And one might think that I should now, you know, include these D3 brains here somewhere in the picture, and then I can, and then I have the full solution. But actually what people realized is that in fact there are, if I ask some physical questions here, there are actually two fully consistent ways to answer them based on these two pictures. Okay. So let me do one particular example that was one of the important calculations that led up to this ADS-CFT conjecture. So what I want to consider is sending in some very low energy excitation from infinity towards this stack of D brains. Okay, so consider, and I want to calculate the absorption cross section. Okay, so basically how, if I send in a wave of say the dilaton field as an example of a scalar field, then I can calculate, you know, how big in cross-section does this D-brain look. And you can calculate that in actually two ways, which are both sort of standard.
The metric that you wrote down here,
yes,
is good when you're looking far away from the D-brain or at all scales.
Okay, well, so I claim that if I take n to be very large, then I should be able to trust this. So in particular, if I take g string n to be very large, then this length scale associated with the solution should be very large compared to the string scale. And so eventually I should be able to trust it at all scales. Okay, so.
I mean, you want n to be large, but g string to be small.
Okay, we'll talk about exactly that. So far I'm just asking about when is the supergravity solution valid, okay? And that should be true if this particular combination is large, okay? So right, we should also worry about whether say quantum string corrections are going to be large. And then we might want to also make some restriction on the string coupling itself or the Newton constant. Okay, so we'll see that. Okay. Good. So now I'm going to send in some very low energy excitation and ask about what the absorption cross section is. And the way that I can calculate that in this picture is just that I have some metric, I have some supergravity solution, and if I look at the fluctuations about that particular solution, then I get a wave equation associated with whichever field I happen to choose. Okay, so I'm going to have, I can, people looked at various modes, but one of the simplest is to choose the dilaton because that has a particularly simple equation of motion on this space. And then you can try and find a solution of the wave equation with the boundary conditions that the wave is purely ingoing as you go very far down this throat. Okay, so as you take the limit r goes to zero, I want to demand that my wave is purely ingoing and look for a solution of this overall wave equation with those boundary conditions. Okay, so there should be some ingoing wave here and the wave that I send in and then some outgoing wave. And basically using some, I mean, in fact, you can reduce this, technically it reduces to a one-dimensional problem, and you can solve this in kind of in a complete analogy to say some Schrodinger equation in one dimension. You solve the wave equation and you can calculate this absorption cross-section. So that gives me some answer here. Okay, so the main point is that there's a very well-defined way to get an answer out of this, okay, without having to put any d-brains in explicitly. Now on this side, what I can do is a very different sounding calculation, and that is to take this bulk mode, so this is now the supergravity mode, and I'm just going to let this propagate in flat space until it hits this d-brain. Now I told you this d-brain was some field theory coupled to these bulk modes, and it couples in a very particular way that you can calculate. Okay, so so there's a term in the action for a d3 brain that has a coupling between this dilaton field and various operators on the world volume. Okay, so actually the leading operator coupled to the constant mode of the dilaton is just trace f squared, your original action, and that has to do with the fact that the dilaton controlled the coupling. So changing the dilaton a little bit is going to change this term in front of the f squared. Okay, but essentially all you have to know is that there's some operator here for a given field that couples the bulk mode to the field theory. And now what I can do, given this coupling, is I can do a field theory calculation, which says that I send in this bulk mode, and so I take some time-dependent thing here, and what can happen then is that you can create particles. So based on this operator, you can calculate the full amplitude for creation of all possible final state particles. Yes.
And how do you cross the facility quantum field theory when GSM is big?
Okay, good. So we're going to do this calculation. I mean, that's an important point that we'll get to, but in fact you can't trust it when GSN is big, or you wouldn't. Okay, it turns out that you can because of supersymmetry, but I'm going to do this calculation assuming that GSN is small. Yeah, so it turns out that because of supersymmetry, in fact, you can trust that calculation. Okay, so actually, when people first did these types of things, they were a little bit more blind, and I mean the supersymmetry argument wasn't really there. Okay, so basically, people just went ahead and calculated here where they could calculate, which is GSN large, and then they went ahead and calculated here where they could calculate, which is GSN small. Okay, so we do this calculation. Okay, either you can just sum over all final state modes, or actually there's a fancy way to do it, which says that somehow the sum over all possible final states you can actually extract from a two-point function of this operator, so some correlation function. Okay, you don't really need to know the details of that. I mean, it's basically just some technical way of actually so the calculation can be done by calculating the two-point function of this whatever operator couples to that mode, and you can extract the cross-section from analytic properties of that. So you can do this calculation and calculate this sigma field theory. And this has been done, for example, for the dilaton mode, then you can take all possible partial waves. Okay, so remember when you calculate scattering in quantum mechanics, you can consider S-wave scattering, where you have some homogeneous spherical wave coming into your scattering center, or you can consider various higher angular momentum modes. Okay, so these calculations have been done for all of these partial waves, and it turned out that they exactly agree. Okay, and in fact the agreement is quite impressive. So just to demonstrate that, I'm going to write down the general formula for the lth partial wave, so the lth angular momentum mode. So the cross section is given by this formula. So kappa is Newton's constant, which is proportional to g string times alpha prime squared. Okay. So I don't expect you to remember this. I've just written it down to impress upon you the fact that this is a very non-trivial function of L. It's not just some particular number that happened to agree by chance. It's some very non-trivial function of this parameter L, as well as these other parameters. And calculating this thing in two absolutely different ways, okay, I mean, the techniques of the calculation seem completely different when you actually do them. So you're not really obviously doing the same thing in any sense, but you get exactly the same answer. Okay. So. Yeah. Okay. So n is again the number of d brains. Yeah. So kappa. Right. So kappa is gs times alpha prime to the fourth. Okay. So kappa is the Newton constant for this particular dimension. Okay. So it's proportional to this string coupling and this alpha prime to give it the right dimensions. Okay. Okay. So when you see this, then you can ask, well, you know, what is going on here? How can these two things be exactly the same? And somehow it suggests to you that in fact, you know, all of this field theory information. Okay. All of the possible endpoints of the scattering, at least in this low energy limit. Okay, so I should have said that I emphasized at the beginning that we're taking a very low energy mode, and the reason was that we don't want to excite higher string modes on these D brains. We just want this field theory calculation to be valid. So at least in this low energy limit. All of the information that was contained in this D-brain calculation somehow must be present here in this supergravity calculation. Okay, so the thing that's causing the absorption here is going to all these modes on the D-brain, but here you don't see any of that. You just see that, you know, this throat geometry is somehow telling you, you know, how much is scattered back. So roughly speaking, then it looks like there's some kind of miracle where this geometry is somehow has the same physics in it as this field theory. Okay, so now we can try and make that more precise, as Maldacena did in his famous paper. Oh, I should have. Okay. Okay, so how can we really make a strong statement that picks out exactly what things are equivalent here? Okay, so what you can do then is just consider. Okay, so it was important that we were focusing on some low energy mode. So what I want to do first is consider some kind of low energy limit of this picture. Okay, maybe there's some correspondence for higher energies, but so far our evidence is just in the limit where the energies of my excitations are much smaller than the string scale. Okay, so I want to take a limit where I only consider energies where E times square root alpha prime, so the energy measures in string units, should go to zero. And now let's look at our low energy description of this physics. Okay, so the effective action. Okay, so first there was this field theory that lives on the brain. Okay, and now I told you that was some kind of a field theory. The leading term is like F squared, but in string theory you can calculate the higher energy corrections coming from all these massive string modes. If you integrate those out, then you actually have higher dimension terms that you can calculate. Okay, so these come with powers of alpha prime in front, so again the string scale. But in our particular limit, then these alpha prime corrections go to zero. Okay, so So the higher dimension operators that are associated to our D-brain from string theory physics are going to be irrelevant in this limit. Okay, so it's just like this usual picture where whatever this field theory is in the high energy ultraviolet, we know that only the renormalizable things here at low energies are going to be important. And So the low energy physics associated with the brain at least should just be given by this leading term, okay, which I can tell you precisely, but the first part of it is just the usual F squared action for the gauge field. Well, we also have some interaction term with the bulk, and we have some bulk action. But you can show that all of the interactions here, so the interactions with the between the bulk field and these brains, as well as the interactions between the massless fields and the bulk, are all controlled by some coupling, which is dimensional. Okay, so it's basically just the familiar fact that gravity is controlled by this Newton constant, which is a dimensional a dimensionful parameter. So at low energies, gravity becomes negligible, and that turns out to be also true for the couplings between the brain modes and the bulk modes. So these both have interactions. Controlled by this Newton constant, which I told you was proportional to G string times alpha prime squared. I think I told you that. It's alpha prime to the fourth over here. Okay, one of those is right. Okay, so in this alpha prime, again, for this alpha prime going to zero limit, so the dimensionless thing you can make here is this object times some powers of the energy, and that's going to go to zero in our low energy limit. Okay, so what this whole thing reduces to in this picture is some free gravity. Okay, so our super gravity. Okay, so just these free modes in the bulk whose coupling has now gone to zero, plus our field theory. Okay, which turns out to be interacting. Okay, as long as we have more than one brain, it's interacting because the coupling here is dimensionless for this 3+1 dimensional theory. It's independent of alpha prime. It's in fact just related to the string coupling itself. Okay, so this field theory here turns out to be, again, it has these 16 supersymmetries, and that basically completely determines it to be what's called n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. I'll describe that precisely next time. And now in the other picture, so let's see what happens. Well, the other picture is all gravity. So it seems like then everything should just become free in this limit. Okay, but we have to take into account this redshift that I talked about. Okay, so remember that. So I might have thought, and certainly this is true for this part of the theory that's very far away from the D brain. I might have thought that all interactions would go to zero. Okay, so out here at least, kappa goes to zero. So again, we get some free supergravity. Okay, but imagine some mode way down the throat here. If this is sitting at a radius r and has an energy er, okay, then by looking at this dt squared term in the metric, we can calculate what the energy observed by some distant observer, you know, out very far away from this brain is. Okay, so this actually gets redshifted, or blue shifted, I should say. So that E at infinity is actually E at R times root alpha prime over R. Okay. So So I've basically just taken this function f, which was 1 plus big r to the fourth over little r to the fourth, and that appeared to the minus 1/2 power in front of dt squared, and I've extracted just the leading behavior as r goes to 0. So there's this big redshift factor. So that tells me that even in my limit here, there's going to be some place far enough down this throat where I can consider arbitrary excitations, so even excitations that have energies of order the string scale, so arbitrary massive string states and whatever. And to a very far away observer, those will look like they have energy going to zero. Okay, so they'll be consistent with our limit. And to make the comparison, we should really just compare the part of the picture which is the same in the two cases. Okay, so we should do the same thing, take e root alpha prime at infinity to zero. Okay.
Is r is a position of the observer or the excitation?
So r is a position of the excitation. So we imagine that we have an observer out at asymptotic infinity, and he's measuring. So he measures this frequency of some excitation that's way down in the throat. And he's going to see it redshifted very much. And so even these stringy excitations far enough down the throat will be consistent with this low energy limit that we're taking.
He's
going to ignore anything that is high energy or comparable to the string scale. So he's going to say, let's look at the low energy limit of my system, where I only allow, you know, I can only send in things that are.
Formula seems upside down.
Oh, sorry. That's right. Okay. Well, I had it right in my notes, and then I decided it was made a mistake. Okay. So what you conclude then is that in this limit, okay, so this is sort of this infinite throat, and then in this limit, what's going to happen is that basically you'll get something way down in this throat which still has interacting stringy physics together with this free supergravity. And now we can argue actually that those two things are going to be decoupled from each other. And I think the easiest way to see that is actually by this particular formula. Okay, so this formula told us what the absorption cross-section was for some excitation that I send in from infinity with an energy omega, okay, with a frequency omega. So what you see is that if I take this limit where where omega, or the energy, times root alpha prime goes to zero, that in fact all of these absorption cross-sections go to zero. Okay, so that tells me in this low energy limit, if I try to send anything in from outside, then it will never reach. Then it basically the size of this black object or the effect it will have on these excitations that I try to send in from infinity will go completely to zero in my limit. Okay, so from this absorption formula, sigma goes to zero. So this throat physics, which is stringy, decouples, and then you get free supergravity. Okay, so now we have actually two fairly similar statements here. We've taken the low energy limit of this system, and we see that we get some interacting field theory on this D-brain, plus some free supergravity out in the asymptotically flat space. In this picture, we again find some free supergravity out in the asymptotically flat space that can no longer see this brain at all, but we've got still some non-trivial physics way down the throat. Okay, so in this limit, we have to go further and further down the throat, but this throat is infinite. And in fact, that there's a well-defined space-time, which is exactly the limit as we take our original metric and ask, you know, what is the metric far down the throat? Okay, so if we fix a point here and then take take the limit where this part of the space goes off to infinity, then we get a very well-defined metric. And that metric turns out to be what people call ADS5. Okay, so we still have this sphere. Okay, so we still have the sphere S5, which was a constant radius everywhere. And then the limit of this other part of the metric turns out to be this ADS5. So I'll just write that down for the next time. Okay, so limiting throat metric. Okay, so we just get ds squared. So basically all that happens is that where we had this 1 plus r to the 4th over r to the 4th, so we're going to the regime of very small r, so this 1 becomes completely negligible, and then we get a metric which is this plus okay, and another way to write that is just some overall scale. Okay, so we have our sphere of constant radius, and then that's just tensored in with this other part of the space, and this is one form of the metric for what's called ADS5, and we'll see in more detail the properties of that next time. So just to conclude then, I'll now state this correspondence that we at least have motivated. I wouldn't call it a proof, and we'll have to come up with a lot of evidence for it in the following two lectures. But the statement then is that this particular field theory that we get in the decoupling limit, so decoupled now from the bulk physics, which is n equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory, and I'll say exactly what that is the next time. Somehow should be precisely equivalent to this type 2B string theory. Okay, so in particular it's the full string theory, because way down the throat we are able to allow ourselves arbitrary energy excitations, string scale excitations, on this space ADS5 cross S5. Okay, so this was the statement of the Moldesena conjecture, the SCFT conjecture, and the next time we'll really see, how it's possible for these two things to be the same. It's hard even to imagine how this 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory could be the same in any kind of sense as a gravity theory on this ADS5 cross S5 space. So we'll have to see, even the rudimentary thing, we'll look at the parameters of those two things, how those can be identified. We'll see that the symmetries are the same, and then we'll ask about what are the physical observables on each side. Okay, so that turns out to be the spectrum and various correlation functions in the field theory, and we'll see how those can be related. Okay, so that's it for today. Any questions?
It seems that the classical super Yang-Mills theory.
Well, I never said. So we have this interaction doesn't go to zero in the limit. So the string coupling was independent of this alpha prime. And so in order to calculate using that field theory, you're still going to have to include all of the interaction terms that you would have in the full quantum theory. Okay, so all I've made was a restriction to low energies, but I never said anything about that would indicate that I should restrict just to classical physics.